And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and with me in the studio today is Ken Thompson.
Hello, everybody.
And our special guest today is Richard Glover. Richard is the well-known author, newspaper columnist, and the presenter of the top-rating Drive show on 702 ABC Sydney. Richard is the author of some 12 books, including bestsellers like In Bed with Jocasta and Desperate Husbands. His most recent book is Flesh Wounds. Richard, welcome to the program.
Bill, Ken, hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Richard, you have a very good story to tell, and unusually for a memoir, you actually go back before your conception.
Yeah, well, it is a story about parenting. I mean, I'm very happy to be on this show because the idea at the heart of the book, really, is that you can be a good parent yourself even if you had slightly inadequate parents yourself. I mean, we have a whole language about parenting, don't we, about the fact that it's automatic. You know, every mother loves their child, every father loves their child. It's built into our very DNA. We even talk about animals, you know, dogs and their puppies and cats and their kittens and all that sort of stuff as if it is really, really unusual not to have good parents. And if you didn't happen to have good parents, you have a right to feel very aggrieved, and you probably can't go on to be a good parent yourself, and you'll probably have a terrible life. That's the way we talk about it. And yet, if you actually sort of sit down with people, and I've been doing this, you know, talking to people in libraries about the new book in the last month, and say to a group of people, who here felt that they got the love from their own parents, that they'd want to give a child of their own? Now, I'm not saying everybody says no to that. In fact, about 60% on my experience say, yeah, you know what, my parents weren't perfect, but I did get something like the love that I want to give a child of my own from them. But about 40% say no, I didn't get anything like the love I want to give a child of my own. And yet, we're not all mad or dysfunctional or alcoholic or on drugs. You know, most people find the love elsewhere. There is this amazing resilience of human beings that they stitch together a quilt of love from other sources, usually in their from mentors and other people who walk into their life, from their own partner, maybe from their own kids, and they go on to have very successful lives. And most importantly of all, you know, the book is very sort of defiant about this, they become good parents themselves.
In this book, you cover a wide range of emotions, and I guess is the funny part addressed to the 100% of us, and the 40% you estimate didn't get the love they deserved. Is that the sad part?
Look, to literary analysis on your own work is a mug's game. So I'll try to resist the urge, but I do notice about the book myself, and this wasn't particularly intentional, but I do notice that there are a lot of jokes in the beginning of the book, and the jokes kind of run out. And I don't know. And as I say, that wasn't really an intentional thing. So maybe what the book is trying to say subconsciously is that I think humour is a really great way to keep the world at bay and to deal with some of the problems of life. It's a great kind of tool with which you can beat away reality and fashion reality, make the most of things. But maybe it does have its limits.
Well, you quote Sir Francis Bacon at the beginning of the book saying, a sense of humour is given to a man to console him for what he is.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's played a role with you, because you are a very funny man, and it comes across in your radio show and in all your books.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. But I think a lot of people use humour in that way, and they use it as a way of fashioning the world and understanding and kind of limiting its power. Once you've made a joke about something, you do steal a lot of its power. Jimmy Carr, in his book about comedy, quotes, and I don't quite know where he got this from, but he says that I haven't gone and checked it myself, but he says there's a bit in Mein Kampf where Hitler warns people against joking about the Jews, you know, because once you've made a joke about someone, you pull the hatred out of it, which he didn't want to do. You know, he wanted them to hate the Jews. Mm. So it is a very kind of strange thing, the way that comedy can be so empowering, I think.
Yes, you were raised in your early years in Papua New Guinea, and you had a very strong influence on you of Donato and Gogo.
Mm.
I wonder if you could just tell us the role they played in your development.
Yeah, well, I suppose I do have to explain a little bit of the story, and some of this is in the first chapter of the book. But, you know, basically, my mother, when I was growing up, told anybody who wanted to listen that I was an artificial insemination baby, and she used to brag about it and say I was the first artificial insemination baby in Australia. And I know you're probably thinking a bit old for that, Richard, but she's not talking about IVF in the 1970s or anything like that. She's talking old school. She's talking turkey baster. And and when you look back in the history of these things, it's just possible that she's right about that, that in around 1958 when I was born, they did start to use this traditional animal husbandry techniques on human beings. So that isn't as odd as it sounds. What was really odd was the reason she gave for having to have recourse to that technology. And the reason was, and again she would tell anybody who wanted to hear, was that she had never, in the 12 years of marriage, slept with my father. The marriage was unconsummated. And, you know, even in 1958, you had to have sex to have a baby. So they came down from New Guinea to Sydney. She sort of submitted to the procedure. My father gave the sperm, you know, behind the little white curtain and all that. And according to her, it worked. You know, she was both a virgin and pregnant. As I always joke, you know, if you want to call me Jesus, you can. and my father had a slightly different story. He says all of that is true, that she never slept with him, the marriage was unconsummated, 12 years, came down to Sydney, tried to do this procedure. According to him, it didn't work, and she was forced, they went back to New Guinea, and she was forced to sleep with him just the once in order to have me. But, you know, either way, whichever story you believe, it's hard for me to think of myself as a love child. And they were quite distant with each other, these two, and they were always kind of quite distant to me, and that kind of continued really through my childhood. I talked before about the sort of finding the love elsewhere that I think everybody does. And in my case, I suppose there was a piece of luck there in that this was New Guinea. And so there was a New Guinean nanny called Darnota. And in all, you know, my father's quite a keen amateur photographer, and there's millions of photographs of me as a child in New Guinea. And in hardly any of them, I'm with my mother. I'm nearly always with Darnota, and I'm nearly always being carried and loved up, and she's gazing at me, and she's holding me. And often there's her husband, Gogo, you know, very handsome New Guinean warrior kind of looking guy with bare chest, terribly handsome. And he's standing on one side. She's standing there next to him with this beautiful beehive hairdo. And in between them, like a traditional family shot, they're mystifyingly white. So I think I did get an awful lot of love from her. And, the book has got some not very good people, and I'm not talking about my parents here, but some other people who I guess border on the evil. But there's also some really good people in the book. And I think one of the other things the book tries to say is that, you know, if you choose to, and this is not, you know, some people have such terrible childhoods that this is not open to them, and such terrible lives this is not open to them. But I do think for most of us, there are bad voices in your life and there are good voices in your life. And if you choose to, the good can speak with a louder voice. And I think, you know, the book really celebrates some of the people who spoke in that louder voice to me.
Yes, I think your parents, from what I've seen, they did love you, but perhaps in an unusual way. You describe one incident where your mother put all the shoes in line after you'd been swimming at Noosa, and perhaps you wonder, is this her way of showing love to you? And I wonder, did your father have any unusual ways of showing his love for you?
Well, I think, you know, I hope the book is really an exercise in trying to understand them. That in the second half of the book, I actually go to England and try to find out the truth about her, because she always had these quite ludicrous stories about how she came from this aristocratic background that she would again tell everybody. And you know, I knew for a long time that couldn't be true. But we go to England and we do find out the truth actually about why she left and why she lied about her past and why she ignored the fact that she had a family and had sisters and all that. And I hope that the second half of the book, it's a bit of a detective story, I suppose, of piecing it together. But once it's pieced together and once you understand where she was running from and why she was running, then it does bring a sort of whoosh of empathy. I think, again, that's true of nearly everybody, that once you think about your own parents and their limitations, they do obviously have their own baggage and they bring their own dilemmas. You know, for people my age, the parents have often lived through the Depression and lived through the First World War, or if not the Depression, at least the First World War. They've lived through what I think in retrospect was a very strange time, the 1950s, and it caused a kind of strange parenting. I think a lot of the things in this book, even though the stories are very eccentric, you know, the virgin birth and my mother's fake past, they seem like very eccentric stories that only are really about me. But when I talk about the book, it's so interesting that nearly everybody finds that the book is a journey into themselves, that even though the particular eccentricities of my parents perhaps are, you know, not shared very widely, but everyone who reads the book finds a story very similar in their own upbringing. And partly that's because I think some of it's about the 1950s. This whole business whereby we go as parents, as dads, as mums, we go to the soccer field or the rugby field, the cricket field or whatever, on a Saturday or Sunday, and we all stand, and the grandparents come too, and everyone stands and watches the kids. It's hard to remember, but that is a really modern phenomenon. That really didn't happen for kids of my generation. You know, it might have happened with the odd parent, but basically you would cycle to the rugby field or the soccer field, you'd play the game. This is as a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old. You'd play the game, then you'd cycle home, and sometime in the middle of the afternoon, if you had a good dad, he would think to say, oh, did you win? You know, similarly, I mean, my father wasn't particularly a pub drinker, but one of the really common things, again, in anyone who had a childhood in the 60s or the 70s probably, was the scene outside a pub. You know, especially in the country, but in the suburbs as well, there'd be kids in the Family Valiant, lots of kids in the Family Valiant parked outside the pub. The difference between a good father was and a bad father was the good father would come into the pub halfway, you know, would leave the pub halfway through the session and proffer a lemonade or a fire engine, whilst the bad father wouldn't bother. You know, that's the realities of how parenting for a lot of people was in the 60s.
So even though your father is portrayed as distant, not that unusual, and there still was that love underneath.
Yes, I think that's right. He was quite a gregarious. The book, I think, has a fuller portrait of him than I've sort of given you here. He was actually a very gregarious person, but I think he was really crushed. Part of the story I haven't told you here is that if the virgin birth is not enough, when I was 14... my mother ran away with my English teacher from school, who she'd met at parent-teacher night. and they kind of just departed, the two of them. You know, term two, my mother disappeared and my English teacher disappeared. And I think my father really never got over that. I think even though the marriage was weird and unconsummated and all that, he fell into a very deep, deep despond at that point. Well, after it happened, in fact, he left too. He went back to England for a while, and I was left in this suburban house, Canberra, on my own, only for a while. Then he came back, and I must say, before he came back, I was alone for a few weeks, and then he moved a friend of his, an old colleague from New Guinea, moved into the house and looked after me, and he's one of the angels of the book. He turned out to be this really great guy and a great influence, one of those louder voices I was talking about. And so I was fine, but I think my father really never recovered, and he set upon a long and self-destructive course at that point. But he ended up having five wives and
and as many boats, I think.
And many boats. But look, he was, and again, I really hope that if people read this book, they'll feel there's very few people who've read it who don't feel I've been fair to them. I think I've been very fair to them, and I've seen the world through their eyes and understood, you know, the problems that they brought to this. You know, it's not one of those I blame my parents books at all. Mm. I think what it is a book about the fact of human resilience, that people have various problems in their life, but there is this ability to be resilient and this ability to overcome them. And that's really what the book's about.
And you've been able to draw from these other people. You mentioned the friend of your father's who came to live with you. That was Steve Stevens, I think is his name.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you had his influence, and then of course a little bit later you had your wife Deborah came into the picture.
Yeah.
So you've had those good influences that you've been able to draw on to complete the person you are today.
But as I say, again, I think that's a really general thing that, as I say, so many people had some difficulties growing up. So many people have managed to go on to be good parents and go on to have happy and successful lives. And we do it because we do have this ability to find the love elsewhere. And I think, you know, there are other probably people who had really good parents, but then there's a different problem in their life. They've married the wrong person, or the kids have turned out to be terrible. Mm. You know, but again, we don't get to choose which parts of our life work and which parts of our life don't. But most people have a mix. and within that mix you can choose.
I never had the sense that your parents were in any way vindictive or wanting to be harmful to you.
No, absolutely not. I think they were narcissistic, really, to be honest. Mm. I think they were just very self-involved. That's exactly right.
We're speaking with Richard Glover, the author of a new book called Flesh Wounds. And, Richard, I really wanted to ask you about your visit to Armidale, to Doriath. Where your mother was living with the man she ran away with, Mr. Phillips, who you always call Mr. Phillips, I note.
English teacher. Yeah.
Yes, I don't know whether he's got a first name, but...
Well, he's the English... You can't call your English teacher by his first name.
I guess not even at this stage. So, I wonder if you could just tell us about that fabled trip to Armidale.
Yeah. Deborah had met my father quite a few times because, I was still living in the family home. But she'd never met my mother because she'd, as I say, departed when I was about 14. I had very little to do with her at that point. So I thought, look, and we were obviously at that stage of life where we were about to settle down and have kids and things like that. So I thought, God, I better make her aware of the genetic pond into which she's about to leap. So, yeah, we drove up to Armidale in country New South Wales. And he the English teacher, was actually English, and he'd been to Oxford University, a fact that he mentioned every... 4 seconds, and had been taught by C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, and he was obsessed with Tolkien and obsessed with C.S. Lewis as a result. And in fact, the house they built in Armidale was built on sort of Tolkien themes, really. It had a sort of baronial doorway, and it had a sort of big lion knocker on the door. Actually, I think that was probably a bit more C.S. Lewis than the Tolkien. But my mother had a motor car with Bilbo Baggins number plates. And the name of the place itself, Doriath, I later realised was a Tolkien reference. In fact, if you look it up, it actually means the Enchanted Girdle. Enchanted Girdle. And the Enchanted Girdle is this special kingdom in Tolkien where the queen has handed over permission to the king that the king can control who shall enter the magical kingdom and thus protect the queen. So it's really a very sort of particular idea about this fortress relationship those two had, them against the world sort of thing. So, I kind of knew all that, but there were some aspects of that I didn't know. And we rolled down the driveway after the long drive and through the signpost saying Doriath and knocked on the door with the big lion knocker. And that we were greeted at the door by my English teacher and my mother. And they suggested a swim, which seemed a fine idea, after the drive. So we whipped into the bedroom and changed into our cozies and headed out to the pool area. And by the time we got to the pool area, they were both in situ. My mother was in the pool in her bikini. And Mr. Phillips, my English teacher, was marching around, stark naked, except for a terry toweling hat. And he had that all-over tan of the perpetual nudist. And I kind of knew about the Tolkien stuff, but I didn't know about the nudism. And he was obviously really into it. And I hadn't warned Deborah, of course. So we're sort of shown to these banana lounges, and we sit down on the banana. And Deborah sits down on one of the banana lounges. And he's sort of wandering around and wanders over to the banana lounge. I want you to imagine the sort of height level here of a woman sitting on a banana lounge and a man standing next to her, nude. And he's saying, drink, anybody? Drink, old boy? I mean, this is the way he talked. Drink, old boy. Drink, Miss Deborah. And she says, oh, okay, I suppose a soda water. And he strides out to the kitchen. He comes back with a tray. And he kind of stands there right next to her, right next to the banana lounge with this tray of drinks. And it's Armidale in the summer, so it's hot. So he's kind of moving from foot to foot on the hot pavement with the sort of donkey tonga flapping in the wind, sort of 2 inches from Deborah's face. And so Deborah's sort of trying to reach over for the soda water whilst leaning as far away in the opposite direction to talk to my mother. And I find she's talking to my mother about the Maharishi. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, but at the time this would have been the early 80s. There was quite a thing at universities where transcendental meditation was in, and you used to go to these evening free information sessions. And Deborah and I had been to one, for half an hour, and decided we didn't really like it and we couldn't do it and all that. But suddenly to hear Deborah talk, we were devotees, and she said, oh, yes, we're both doing transcendental meditation. I thought, what is she talking about? And it's a very exacting discipline. In fact, you have to meditate 2 hours a day, and we haven't done it yet. And she sort of leapt off the banana lounge and ran towards the bedroom, grabbing me by the hand and pulling me after. And from that on, that stay, every time that either became obsessively Tolkienish or obsessively nudist, suddenly, oh, come on, Richard, we better meditate. So we were the Maharishi's biggest devotees.
That was, yes, the escape. And I know you talk about this dinner party game where everyone describes who's got the weirdest parents. And I was surprised to hear you say that you didn't always win that competition.
Yeah. Well, again, as I say, the book seems very eccentric, but whenever I talk to people about it, they always come back to the idea that this is their story in some way. So many people identify with this story, even though they don't identify with the particulars about it. And I think the reason is because, you know, we are, you know, everyone's got these deeply odd families. I invented this game, as you say, when I was in my 20s, really, called Who's Got the Weirdest Parents? And I still recommend it. It's a great dinner party game. If you've, you know, you've got a dinner party that's running down a bit, you just pop a bottle of wine in the middle of the table and issue the invitation. Okay, who's got the weirdest parents? One story each. You know, winner takes the bottle of wine. And you only need to play that game once, and you will never again look over the red roofs of suburbia without understanding what frothing insanity lies beneath. You know, and as I say, even with my virgin birth and all that, and my mother's fake past, I often lost. Often there was some more bizarre story. And I think one of the funniest things about playing it is that there's always somebody at the table, and you'll find this if you play it yourself, who says, oh, no, look, I couldn't, you know, that sounds fun, I'll enjoy listening to everyone else's stories, but I can't play because my parents are really, really boring and suburban and ordinary. And I'd always remonstrate with them and say, oh, come on, Sue or Philip or, you know, Jean, there must be something. And they say, oh, no, there's not room. Oh, unless you count the way that, you know. And I remember one particular time, this was a friend of mine, Eric, who said, no, I can't play. No, my parents are really... Oh, come on, Eric, there must be... No, there's none. They're really, really boring. They're really, honestly... Come on, Eric, there must be... Oh, okay, he said. This is a real example. He said, okay, finally, unless you count the way... Oh, yeah, well, unless you count the way that my dad, he was an accountant in the city, and he drove home and we had a garage with an open... And he couldn't stand the idea of my mother touching his underwear in any way. So he had a laundry built in the garage, and he'd drive home, strip off all his clothes, launder them before entering the house. Unless you mean something like that.
That would count.
And we'd say, yes, that's what we mean. That's in fact, you win the wine. You know?
Well, I wonder if you might have to extend it to weirdest grandparents for your boys, because I'm sure you and Deborah have done an excellent job with your children. But, Richard, I'm sure we could talk for days, but we've come to the end of the show. You've asked us to play a song. I wonder if you could tell us which song you picked and why you picked it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the things I understand about fandom is that often in adolescence you need something in your life, and I think I did need a kind of father figure in my life. I needed somebody who I could not look up to exactly, but someone I could become obsessed with. And I found that father figure in the most unlikely place. I found it in a white rhinestoned suit standing on a stage in Las Vegas. I found it in Elvis. And I became totally obsessed with Elvis during this period where my mother was, you know, off and all of that. So much so that I print in the book just to convince people that I'm not making this stuff up. My school report even says, you know, his marks are going to improve once this incredible obsession with Elvis Presley ends. And like any true Elvis fan, I'm not one of these people who says, oh, I only like the Sun Sessions, I only like the early stuff. I like it all. And, you know, I even like the ballads. I love those really sort of big emotional songs, like this one, In the Ghetto.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries, 'cause if there's one thing she don't need, it's another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. People, don't you understand? A child needs a helping hand. He'll grow to be an angry young man someday. Take a look at you and me. Are we too blind to see? Do we simply turn our heads and look the other way?
Your little boy with the runny nose plays in the street as the cold wind blows in the ghetto. And his hunger burns. So he starts to roam the streets at night, and he learns how to steal, and he learns how to fight in the ghetto. Then one night in desperation, the young man breaks away. He buys a gun, steals a car, tries to run, but he don't get far, and his mama cries. As a crowd gathers round, an angry young man face down in the street with a gun in his hand in the ghetto. And as her young man dies, on a cold and gray Chicago morning, another little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries.
And that was In the Ghetto by Elvis Presley. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again with our special guest Richard Glover, or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. So it just remains for me to thank our special guest. Thank you very much, Richard, for being on the program.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Bill. Thank you very much, and thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Richard.
And don't forget to look out for Richard Glover's new book, Flesh Wounds. It's been a great show today, and so we'll be back again next week with another show. Until then, it's goodbye from Dads on the Air.